Muscovine. Weeds. We pull them out, we douse them with herbicides, and generally treat them as a huge annoyance. However, our guests today are urging us to take a second look at wild plants, many of which are not only edible, but they're flavorful and nutritious, not to mention quite often free for the taking. There's growing interest in foraging for food. Anyone can do it. And here with the insight are Patrick Hurley, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies and Chair at Ursinus College. He studies urban foraging. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks, Mary. It's wonderful to be here.
And Tama Matsuoka Wong is a professional forager and educator who supplies a number of New York City restaurants. She's author of the book Foraged Flavor, Finding Fabulous Ingredients in Your Backyard or Farmer's Market. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be here.
So many plants, weeds, have gotten a bad rap. Flip that around for us. Why should we give them a chance, Tama?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to think, why are we calling it a weed? Because we're calling it a weed because we've decided it's something that's there that we don't want to be there. Mm-hmm. But actually, a lot of these weeds, if we take a closer look at them, are things that came here from other countries, and some of them are from here, and they're culinary delicacies in other countries. So we're just not even paying attention, and we're missing it, missing out.
Give us some examples of the culinary delicacies that are...
From another country or from here? Because I kind of distinguish it.
Let's start off with other countries.
Other countries. Okay, yeah. So I guess one of them that's an invasive plant right now is autumn olive. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a small tree. It has red berries with silver little beads on them, and the leaves are sort of silvery-backed. When they're very, very ripe, you can make them into a jam, and they're delicious. They're also called Japanese silverberry. And here, you know, it's an invasive plant, so... all the conservation groups are trying to get rid of it because it's taking over.
And yet you have a sprig of it here in studio, and it's absolutely beautiful.
Yes, it is actually beautiful if you look at it.
Where is that normally found? In neighborhoods in South Jersey, Philadelphia? Where'd you find that?
I've seen it anytime you see sort of a field, you'll see these trees starting to grow in them. Or even in people's backyards, they're starting to grow all along the hedgerows, and they actually end up taking over more and more.
And Patrick, let's get you into the conversation here. Foraging is not just for folks who live in suburban or rural areas. People do it in the cities, and there's a growing foraging movement, and Philadelphia is one of those cities in which it's located.
It very much is one of those cities in which it's located. One of the things to point out is that probably urban foraging and suburban foraging has been going on for quite some time. If you look at some of the old memoirs of Italians in New York City, and I suspect this is true in Philadelphia, you'll see mentions to groups of people out harvesting dandelions and then supplying local farmers markets from the turn of the 19th, 20th century. You'll see references to foraging from Philadelphia and the Philadelphia Inquirer at the end of the 1990s, beginning of the 2000s. What we see now seems to be sort of a flourishing of people interested in the practice and an explosion of talk about the topic, particularly in social media locations, blogs, web pages, social media meetup groups, Facebook, what have you, and the proliferation of ways to sort of help people find these species in cities and urban areas.
So if I'm walking down Market Street and there's something popping up through the crack in the sidewalk or maybe over by a lot, I mean, is there potential there?
There is potential. I mean, there's a number of different things you could see. You could see purslane pop up. You could see chickweed in some areas. You could see...
And all are edible.
These are edible species. You know, mm-hmm. Purslane is a commonly sold green in European markets, grocery stores. You increasingly see it here in some farmers markets. Can be eaten in a vegetable, I mean, as a sort of a raw green in a salad, or it can be eaten as a sort of cooked green like you would fix a spinach. And it's quite delicious.
Are urban foragers actually foraging? Because I'm not. You know,
you're out
from
more
the
rural area.
Yeah.
Well, that was my next question.
So, you know, as an environmental social scientist, one of the things we're trying to look at is what are people actually doing? What is the sort of range of species that are harvesting? How are they using? What are the motivations? And then what are the concerns, both of foragers and what are the concerns of managers? And one of the, you know, quick concerns is what types of toxics, or diseases might people be exposed to in harvesting these items, what I would say what we're finding is that people have wide tolerances of the amount of risk they're willing to take in where they harvest items. We don't really know very much about what people might be exposed to in these plants. We have some indication from some of the urban farming and urban gardening literature that concerns about lead in the soil being transferred or taken up in the plants, in certain types of plants, we should be concerned. But we don't really know much about the types of plants that people might be foraging. There's some rules of thumb that foragers use. For example, you'll hear, I don't harvest within 10 to 25 feet of the side of the road because that's a plant that might be in an area where that soil still has a fair amount of lead in it from, you know, the pre sort of mid-1970s era when we banned leaded fuels. But we don't, again, have very much research on what people might be exposed to in these situations to answer that question.
So where do urban foragers then focus their efforts? I know, for instance, in Philadelphia, a lot of city parks are off limits to this.
City parks and street trees.
Okay.
So one thing to remind folks is that Philadelphia street trees, that is the trees between the roadway and the sidewalk, are technically part of the park system. And they're managed by Fairmont Park. And so that's an area where foraging is prohibited. Then there are other trees which might be sort of between a building and a sidewalk. They're likely private property, but in some sort of public right-of-way. I don't know the specifics about sort of how Philadelphia ordinances apply to those places. Mm-hmm. But for example, I was walking down Spruce Street at the backside of the University of Pennsylvania Hospital this morning and noticed there are some Coosa dogwood shrubs with very edible Coosa dogwood berries on the shrubs.
Okay.
I was thinking, gosh, maybe I should take some to the radio station today. And I thought, wait a minute, I don't really know what the legal status is of harvesting these berries.
We're going to just take a couple and shove them in your pocket now.
Right. And you know, this is to say, in harvesting and of many plants and plant-related products in the area's parks is off limits, it's prohibited. There are a couple places where some things can be harvested, but generally it's prohibited.
Okay, we'll get back to that in just a moment.
I actually do work with I work with conservation groups, and I work with two of them since we're talking about the Philadelphia area in Pennsylvania. One is the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education, and I'm doing a workshop there in January, and they do permit foraging under my supervision. If you come to one of my workshops, it's a way, and we're very specific about what plants. As Patrick and I were speaking, not all plants are the same, and I think that's really, really important if we're thinking about the ecology. And so they're trying to get rid of a lot of invasive plants. Some of them are some of the popular ones that Patrick tells me, like mugwort.
So eat them.
So they, you know, We can have a supervised foraging for people that want to get things and want to make sure they have permission and want to make sure they understand the history of that land use. So there are ways that you can do this without, you know, if you're concerned about the quality. But I always think if it's private property and you think the person doesn't care, then it shouldn't matter. Just go ask them. It's, you know, maybe I'm just old fashioned, but I think
if they put herbicides down. I mean, that's something that you want to know. Okay, you'd mentioned you'd mentioned Patrick that dandelions just a moment ago, and I have to say, last night I was just flipping through the channels, and I landed on the Waltons for like about 5 seconds. But the reason I stayed there was because they started talking about dandelion jelly. And you have a recipe for that in your book.
Oh, yes.
Dandelion jelly. I'd never heard of it until I saw it in your book, and then I heard it on this old television show, which I think was based on a memoir of life in the Depression era of the United States. So people used to make this, is the point I'm trying to make.
And the thing about the dandelion jelly is because that actually is something that one of the restaurants I foraged for in New York, Danielle, in New York City, a very high-end restaurant. But the executive chef, Jean-Francois, his mother in France made dandelion jelly all the time. And the key that they thought makes it beautiful is to leave the little yellow petals in. So you have that beautiful petal. You know, it's not just like a liquid. It has the texture and the beauty of the little petals in there.
So do you use the flower and the stem to make the jelly?
Just
the flower.
The flower, but you keep the petals and you don't strain them out.
And what's
with a little yellow. Yeah.
What's the flavor like?
It's honey-like.
Really?
Yeah.
So another idea for those darn dandelions that people are spraying, pulling, yanking.
And dandelion is a great example of a plant that has sort of multiple uses, right? You can harvest the flower head and make dandelion wine. I was biking home from school one day and rode past a guy who was sitting in the middle of his lawn with a little plastic pitcher picking something. And then I realized that he was picking the dandelion flower heads off of his dandelions in his backyard, and stopped and talked to him. And so he makes dandelion wine. Right. And but you can also use the root to make a tea that's sort of more not a food at that point, but really talking about sort of crossing into the medicinal and sort of consumption of a plant for the health benefits as well. So three different parts of this often unwanted plant that have important uses.
So and leaves can be used for salad, right?
If
you pick them early.
Early, when they're young, before flowering.
Before they get there.
And then you might want to have it with some, you know, instead of heaping for my children, instead of heaping a pile of dandelion leaves on a plate, you may want to have it with some other things like our recipe suggests, like with a potato and maybe a little vinaigrette. I have to say our favorite all-time household recipe for dandelions is the flowers, to tempura the flowers. Do you know what I mean? You just lightly, it's not deep fried, lightly fry, and they become like, you know how shrimp tempura, if people have had that?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It has like, it's puffy and sweet, and that's why it tastes good, and you have it with that savory dipping sauce with radish. I don't know if you've had it that way.
No, but it sounds delicious.
But the dandelion flower is even better because it puffs out like popcorn.
My wife's also cooked to sauteed it as a green and put it in a pasta dish with some pine nuts and raisins, and you get sort of this fruity, nutty, slightly bitter, very savory pasta.
Wow. Well, it all sounds delicious, and I don't mean for this hour to be an ode to the dandelion.
Yes,
but, you know, a question comes out of this because dandelions, people have cooked and et cetera with dandelions for forever. So why has the focus, the attitude toward dandelions, and maybe we can take that to other invasives and plants, why hasn't it changed?
I think there's a number of factors. One is sort of if we look at sort of the structural or institutional barriers to the way we manage some lands, and I think here about housing subdivisions and suburbia, where in many places the dandelion is essentially a prohibited plant, right? We want to get rid of it. I think we're experiencing with foraging an effort to sort of reconnect people to the usefulness of particular plants, to the sort of presence of plants, and thinking about connections to nature. That's one of the things we hear from folks sort of consistently when we do interviews, is this is a way for them to reconnect to their local nature, their local ecosystems, their local forests, what have you, and to learn about those plant uses.
All right, this is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscoane. We're talking about foraging for food. What's in your backyard? Tama Matsuoka Wong, author of the book Foraged Flavor, is with us. Also, Patrick Hurley studies urban foraging and is associate professor of environmental studies and chair at Ursinus College. Join the conversation. The number is 1-888-477-9499. Be right back.
I'm Jerry McGinnis, managing partner for KPMG Philadelphia. Our audit, tax, and advisory professionals are passionate about turning knowledge into value to benefit our clients and the capital markets we serve. More at kpmg.com. KPMG supports WHYY.
Opera Philadelphia presents The Barber of Seville. Rossini's rapid-fire comedy kicks off with a famous overture and veers into a series of disguises, trickery, and tomfoolery. The Barber of Seville at the Academy of Music from September 26th through October 5th. Tickets and information for The Barber of Seville at operaphila.org or 215-893-1018. Opera Philadelphia supports WHYY.
What looks like a baby Jack in the pulpit but acts more like Mickey's broomstick in Fantasia? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll warn you about the pesky weed called Pinellia, plus how to cultivate edible plants indoors and answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturdays at 7 a.m. and again at noon, right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first ever Lincoln MKC with available active noise control that reduces unwanted cabin noise to help provide a more pleasant driving experience. More at Lincoln.com.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawane. We're talking about foraging for food, wild plants that are edible and delicious and quite possibly growing enthusiastically in our backyards. Don't even know about it. Our guests are Patrick Hurley, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies and Chair at Ursinus College. He studies urban foraging. And Tama Matsuoka Wong is a professional forager and educator and author of the book Foraged Flavor. If there's anything you'd like to know about gathering and cooking with wild plants, these are the folks to talk to. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. An email works just as well, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So I was reading a list of some of the wild plants that grow in Philly, and I came up with, at least according to the list, Japanese wineberry, black walnut, we all know about that, serviceberry, morel mushrooms, garlic mustard, and of course, dandelions. When you go out, though, if you're somebody who is new to this, how do you go out and figure if you're looking for mushrooms? I mean, obviously, you've got to know what you're looking for so you don't get sick. So what are the do's and don'ts?
The first thing I would say is what you hear or read repeatedly in field guides, and there are a number of field guides and other books out there that talk about urban foraging. Some of which are sort of memoir, a seasonal walk through what you might find in the city. Others are specifically field guides, is multiple field guides. You really need to compare plants in a particular location to multiple pictures. But I would suggest there's a number of meetup groups that you can find online. One example is the Philadelphia Foodies group, mm-hmm. or Wild Foodies group, excuse me, which has a webpage, and they have weekly meetings where they take folks out and educate them about many of these wild weeds and other plants and how they're used, and talk about ethical practices and sustainability concerns and any number of other issues. But so there are lots of opportunities to get out with people who have some identification expertise and learn about the plants directly. But multiple field guides and sort of double checking the plant you're looking at against the pictures, it's sometimes tempting to take that risk. You really want to taste this new distinctive flavor, but you don't have the confidence or the expertise to identify it, and there can be some consequences of not being cautious.
So, and Tama, when you first went from, you were a corporate lawyer,
yes.
and decided to kind of move over into this
field. I don't
know
if it's really a decision.
What a career change. But anyway, when you started, you write that you could only identify two plants.
Yes.
So what were the plants, and what was the process for you in trying to determine what was edible, what was delicious?
I think it was like oak and dandelion. I could at least identify those two. But and I think the one thing I'd say for people is don't try and do too much at once. Find like something that's in your backyard or your container, even on your terrace, and just look at these small things and find like what's there. Don't try and learn 100 things at once, and get to know that one or two, and you'll kind of go from there. And for me, I actually took a lot of classes at the Bowman's Hill Wildflower Preserve. They have classes all winter. They have winter workshops, and they also have acreage, so that you can go out on a little field thing afterwards, and they have naturalists there who will look at things. There's also a lot of plant ID forums that I know actually botanists, and the botanist that mediates my webpage is one of the top field botanists definitely in the area.
So you did your homework.
And, you know, but talking to other people and just learning things little by little and not trying to learn 100 things at once.
It can be a social experience, it sounds like.
It is very much a social experience. I would also add that we have a number of local arboretums, right, where people can visit and see many of these plants and identify them. It is prohibited to harvest in those areas.
But at least you can learn.
Right.
Oh, just one quick question, Tama. How did you go from point A to point B, corporate lawyer to professional forager? That sounds like such a career jump. Just wondering what the mental process was.
As I was saying, it wasn't a process. It was just that I started getting sucked into something that was so fascinating and creative that it just, and actually everything that I've learned in business, I needed for what I'm doing now.
Okay. Let's get to the phones. Beth from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. You're live on Radio Times. Hi.
Hi. I basically have a comment. I think it's great that you guys are going to be giving people resources to learn about this, because as someone who grew up on a farm up in the Lehigh Valley, we didn't look at it as foraging. It was pretty much you know, there was stuff that we planted that we ate, and then there was stuff that just came up that we ate. And, you know, we did dandelion and hickory nuts and all the berries. And my grandparents were from a generation where they also did medicinal plants. You know, my grandfather would pick yarrow and use it for cuts to stop bleeding and, you know, all sorts of things that it seems like we just kind of soaked it up from being there.
Sure.
But, I mean, as far as the inner city goes, it's hard for people to find produce, and I think it's a good idea to let them know that this stuff is growing right in their front yards. Every spring, dandelion is an excellent source of vitamin A. You can just go out, pick it, and eat it.
Beth, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You know, she mentioned people in the city. There are immigrant groups who forage in the city, right, Patrick?
Very much so. In Philadelphia, we've been looking at Philadelphia mostly through the lens of the local food movement, but in New York City, we've my colleague in the Forest Service, Marla Emery, and I, together with a doctoral candidate from the University of Nebraska, have been looking at Chinese immigrants and their foraging practices in New York City. We've talked to about 40 folks at this point. And there's any number of ways that Chinese immigrants and their descendants are maintaining cultural practices and ties to particular plants. Mugwort is one that comes up, which is an invasive forest plant that many managers want to get rid of. Mm-hmm. Mulberry, which is a common red mulberry, is a common tree that we find in many urban areas in the northeastern U.S., is another important one. Dandelion, again. And ginkgo nuts, which is these fruits that come from female ginkgo trees, which for many managers and many people is a nuisance. So the idea of someone harvesting or picking up those fruits and carrying them away to do something with is actually somewhat appealing, we hear, although we hear some foragers just squeeze out the nut that's inside. I need to mention that ginkgo is an example of a plant that the handling and processing is important. If you were to just pick up the ginkgo mm-hmm. berries, it looks like a yellow cherry. It has a compound in it that treats your skin a lot like poison ivy. So it's something that you need to wear latex or some sort of gloves or protective wear because you really don't want, you know, this allergic sure. rash outbreak on your hands.
So another good reason to get a field guide or go to a class and learn before you go. We got a comment from Virginia in Wilmington, Delaware. Lamb's quarter is great, but animals like it. A problem she has is that cats can make a lot of weeds inedible.
Hmm. Oh.
Yeah, pets, well, you know, that's part of the problem. You don't want to pick anything, you know, near right, a litter right, box right. or perhaps a sand, not a litter box, obviously. I'm thinking of a sandbox. Kids play. Sometimes cats go there, you know, or
You could let your lamb's quarters grow really tall and just harvest the tips or the leaves on the side that are higher than the cat can go. That's one idea. I love it. We ate it all summer.
And lamb's quarters is considered a spinach substitute because the nutritional value is similar to, or some people would argue better
Michael
than
Pollan
spinach, right?
says better.
So when do you pick these greens? Is it better to pick them toward the beginning of the season? Do they have more flavor when they're young? As the summer moves on, do they become a little more bitter?
Well, I would say that if you look in the farmers' markets, most of the times farmers just in the spring they're just chopping off the tops. Mm-hmm. I have my own techniques to make the season last longer through the whole summer.
Yeah.
Which because I'm picking the leaves a certain way, but most people can't probably be bothered to do it that way. But if you do pick the young leaves, you keep clipping it back, the plant will continue to regenerate new shoots for the entire summer. Really.
So a good example of that is milkweed. Right.
I'm not foraging milkweed.
But that there's another.
You like it, you don't?
No, well, the muttock butterfly.
No, well, this is what I was going to say. This is a plant that, if it's picked early enough, will recover. But at some point, you probably don't want to continue to harvest it. Multiple parts of the plant can be harvested. But it's a source plant, or a food source plant and breeding source for monarch butterflies. So it's something that illustrates that there are some wildlife-human conflicts and sharing that might need to go on and thinking about that as a sustainability issue. But another important point here is there are some plants that you can't harvest after a certain period because they become poisonous. Pokeweed is a great one. It has to be harvested very early on. The problem is, if you're learning to forage, it's very hard to learn how to identify early on for many people. So you learn to identify it after it's matured and can no longer be eaten. But then you've sort of got to remember,
so that's what we had,
go back into the next year.
When we did the forage flavor book, it was actually difficult and it's not perfect, but we tried to take pictures of it when it was at the time you would pick it. Because mm-hmm. a lot of these identification books are when it's flowering, when it's either too old or bitter. And I'm not sure we're completely, but at least you can see what it looks like when it's at the time you would harvest.
Yeah. The illustrations are beautiful.
The one thing I wanted to point out was that is in season now, which we were talking about, was sumac. Because that's out now.
Well, now you think of poison with sumac.
Yeah, so that's one of the things where I'm kind of a little bit on a rampage about this because I'm looking for sumac because I'm making this sumac aid and sumac spice, and I brought some. And it's so easy to identify because it has this beautiful torch. It's a tree, a short tree, mm-hmm. and it has these beautiful torch-like fruit and seeds cones.
She's got
it's
one in
beautiful.
Studio. Yeah.
And I don't really know why, but I've noticed that people along in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, along the roads where you see it a lot, are actively spraying just the sumac. And I think it's because they think it's poison sumac. I can't think of any other reason because it's poison sumac is white and it usually grows in moister climates. So it's not the one alongside the road that has these red clusters. So it's very easy to identify. And whoever's spraying the stuff, I'm thinking it's poison sumac, please stop.
Take a class. This might bring us to our next caller, okay. Steve in Berks County. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, Steve. I'm just curious, is there like a guide or any kind of a book that you could like go to Barnes & Noble or somewhere and just get a book that you would be able to find a guide to help somebody who doesn't really know much about finding wild plants that are like edible or medicinal?
Well, yeah, he's looking for a source. Again,
there's the Peterson Guide to Foraging Wild Plants. There's a new book from Leigh Emeritus, 2014, called Northeast Foraging 120 Wild and Flavorful Edibles. And there's, of course, your book, Tama.
Forage Flavor. Thanks, Steve, for the call to Radio Times. Good luck to you. Wayne in Glenside, you're next. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was just wondering if your guest knew of the Dandelion Festival that's in Vineland, New Jersey.
Ooh.
In the spring. Oh, my God, they have dandelion butter and wine and everything you could think of. But also, I didn't know if you knew that Vineland, New Jersey is the largest producer in the world of farm-raised dandelions, which are exported to France.
So I didn't realize that people were actually raising dandelions.
For export.
Interesting. And so in France, obviously, it is
part of
the cuisine.
Because that's where they're, you know, it's part of, when they see it, they just have this sort of, you know, memory, like, you know, they're all get excited about it, and it's sort of this whole memory of their where that when they grew up, etc. So that's really interesting. And I know we're still talking about dandelions, but when I was actually in the restaurant, these Italians came in and they were showing this honey, and they had these cards that they showed, and one of them was a card of this of the whole hillside in Italy covered with dandelion. Like, look how beautiful this is. And I was laughing because so many people here in suburban Pennsylvania, New Jersey would look at that and, you know, their neighbors would be so angry to see that.
It's war.
And the rest of the world, people think it's beautiful.
So I think back to Beth's call about sort of the harvest of items in agricultural fields in the Lehigh Valley. But a number of the sort of immigrant groups in southeastern Pennsylvania have harvesting traditions of these wild plants. Pennsylvania Germans, ground cherry. You may have heard of ground cherry pie. Italian immigrants, dandelion, but any number of mushrooms. Eastern Europeans, Russian, Ukrainian, Polish, harvesting mushrooms as well. Korean and Chinese harvesting ginkgo nuts, among other things. And so some of those species are native and some of those species are invasive, but they sort of illustrate these traditions and various ethnic and cultural groups that have come to the United States.
Patrick, how would you characterize the foraging community in the Philadelphia area? Is it growing, small? What is it?
That's a really difficult question to answer for a number of reasons. Part of it is a methodological question. We find that when we talk to people first and ask them, do they forage, they don't immediately recognize what they do as foraging. And so that makes doing sort of random surveys and phone surveys difficult. The one random survey that's been done in the United States, which was actually focused in New England area, found that 17.6% of people who answered the question had in the previous year foraged something. That was higher than the participation rate in golf and other recreational items. And the percentage fell when we went sort of 5 years back. And it's difficult to know whether those people were just eating some berries while they were hiking or if they were systematically gathering items with sort of a strong commitment to making this part of their life. But again, like so many people probably engage in this activity.
I have to say, like when I'd never heard of foraging. The first time I heard of it was Daniel Boulud came to me and said, "Hi, Tama, how's foraging?" And I sort of was like, "What?" I thought it was like dumpster driving or used something. Like,
sure.
I didn't know what it was. And it was only later on that someone else told me that this is this thing, because I guess I am an immigrant, or my father came from Japan, and my in-laws mm-hmm. are from China. So I had all this information from them about what they did in traditions. And I really think that part of the reason, and I know some of the callers have talked about that they've learned these traditions from their grandparents, and I think where we've lost that connection is where we're all immigrants, but some of us have no longer kept that knowledge from where we came sure. from, and we certainly haven't gotten a lot of it from the people that were living here when immigrants first came over. So I think in a way we are a nation of immigrants, and that's why we've forgotten some of this more than maybe people in other countries.
Tama, compare the flavor of wild plants to those you find in the produce section.
Oh, well, I think that they're more complex. Sometimes they're stronger, so you're not going to need to eat as much to feel satisfied. And there is actually a really good book, which I think talks about the nutritional value and how they're different. And I think the nutrition also translates to the flavor. It's called Eating on the Wild Side. And it talks a lot about how they're have much more phytonutrients and nutritional value, wild plants, than do cultivated plants because they haven't been coddled.
So if you're going to cook with wild plants, you might not need as much seasoning, as much salt. Maybe it's not as much pepper.
So right now I am using my sumac spice instead of salt. Like, we don't need salt when we put this on.
And what is that flavor?
It's tart and fresh, but it has kind of like a little cherry notes and a little bit of toasty notes. And we think it's much more superior than the European sumac, which is mostly imported from Turkey.
And you use it on?
Well, okay, right now our family is a little bit crazy about this. So they're putting it on pasta. They put it on anything that they think
is
kind of, yes. But it's traditionally, you can see it in a lot of Middle Eastern cooking for grills and on vegetables. There's this one chef, Otolenghi, who's very, very popular. He has like tons and tons of sumac recipes on yogurt with vegetables, beets, all kinds of stuff, which is great.
It's most often in what Turks call kofta, which is a mm-hmm. Turkish meatball. So it's ground up in the little beef patty and then grilled outside on a grill, part of a picnicking experience.
And picked from the side of the road?
No, so I do not pick from the side of the road. And I am actually working on a sumac farm to restore part of a preserved farmland in New Jersey.
Okay, quickly, why not from the side of the road?
Because of the pollutants and because I don't think there's a way to get permission to pick things from the side of the road.
And they might be sprayed.
Yes.
It's okay. an area that's often sprayed. So right.
We're coming up on a break. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moss-Gawain, and we're talking about foraging for food. We've got a lot of calls. We still have some lines open. So if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Back in a moment.
The American Philosophical Society Museum invites visitors to remember where it all began, to view Jefferson's handwritten draft of the Declaration of Independence, and to discover what the city of brotherly love was really like during the Revolutionary War. Jefferson's Guide to Philadelphia provides a view of your city and its history through new eyes. Jefferson, Philadelphia, and the Founding of a Nation, now through December. To learn more, apsmuseum.org. The APS Museum supports WHYY.
The elevator punch can't be the end of the Ray and Janae Rice story.
Janae will not realize her situation until she's actually removed herself from it.
An abused spouse takes us into the scary closed world of a football marriage coming apart and the NFL not in the huddle. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Guided by Quaker values, Folkways at Gwinnett, a continuing care retirement community for active adults 65 and over since 1967, supports WHYY. Folkways provides residents with proven financial stability, a comprehensive health care program, and a community where friendship, caring, dignity, and respect are a way of life. One- and two-bedroom apartments, highlighting Folkways' newest design features, are now available. To experience life at Folkways and to arrange a personal tour, 215-283-7010.
This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about foraging for food, wild plants, also known as weeds. If you'd like to give us a call, 888-477-9499. Our guests are Patrick Hurley, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies and Chair at Ursinus College. He studies urban foraging. And Tama Matsuoka Wong is a professional forager, an educator, and author of the book Foraged Flavor. And we've gotten a lot of calls here, so let's get to them. First, we've actually got a message from Erin, and she says, I am interested in foraging some butternuts that grow at the edge of an old, out-of-use railroad bed. If there are contaminants in the soil, would they find their way into the nuts, or would the nuts be safe? What do you think?
I have talked to I've been talking to some people. I work with Audubon Society a lot, and they actually think that railroad beds are pretty heavily sprayed these days. They used to just mow them, but now they've gone to really spraying them heavily with pretty heavy. So I would be very careful about that.
And any number of things that might have come off trains passing by. It's an area that actually a lot of these useful and edible plants occur. But an area that you really see folks try to avoid or are quite wary of it. What I would say is we don't really fully know what might be in that butternut, and I would
use caution.
Exactly.
All right. Sharon in Downingtown, welcome to Radio Times. You're live.
Hi. I just wanted to say it's really funny when I go walking anywhere with my husband because I'll just be walking along and grab something and eat it. And he grew up on Long Island, and he's horrified. Like, he just is so resistant to knowing that I grew up with this knowledge. I grew up an hour south of here in rural Maryland. And almost all year we had something, and we kind of judged where we were. Like, we're going back to school because these are blooming, and May apples are here, so we're almost getting out of school. And it was just so much a part of our daily lives. What I didn't realize, and we had, like, nuts and berries and wild persimmons and all kinds of stuff we ate all the time. What I didn't realize was I failed to pass that on to my kids because I live in suburbia and we're just not out. We walk on trails and things where we're not just rummaging through the woods. And so I really wanted to encourage other parents who have this growing up knowledge that you have to make it intentional to share it because your kids aren't going to just absorb it like we did.
Sure. Mm. Thanks, Sharon, for the call to Radio Times. One caveat I would think is if you're with kids, especially little ones, they tend to stuff things in their mouths pretty quickly. Any insight?
I would just say there's two things. One, there's a lot of tours now in various land trust preserves, parks, again, that give folks the opportunity to learn about these plants. And often kids are really encouraged to come take part in that.
I kind of find that third grade is a really great age because you don't want them to be so young that they don't really can't tell they're stuffing things. And somehow when they get older, they get this more like your husband, they get more fearful about what they're doing. In third grade, they're still so open, but they can tell, like, you know, don't just stuff anything in your mouth. So,
all right, back to the phones we go. Bill in Wilmington, Delaware, you're live on Radio Times.
Hi, I just wanted to know what's some tasty vegetables I can harvest at this time of year.
Good question. We're heading into fall.
Okay, heading into fall, a lot of the non-native plants come back. So I actually am seeing some nettle. If you've mowed the place where nettle is, nettle's coming back now. You'll see chickweed. You'll see some of the wild cresses, not watercress, but wild cress coming back as the days get shorter and it gets cooler. So
burdock is another one, I believe. I would have to double check that, but
I'm not really sure.
Is there a stinging nettle?
Yeah, so stinging nettle, if you mow it, it comes back now.
Well, how do you – I mean, I've never touched the plant. How do you handle a stinging nettle? Does it
with
sting?
Glove, yeah, it does. But actually – and there's a whole thing that actually is supposed to be good for you if you get stung a little bit, not, you know, like – because
painful
it actually
food.
Is supposed – so people that have rheumatism or inflammatory things is supposed to actually help the bodily system. So even if you got stung a little, just think it's good for you. But some of these greens will be coming back as the days get cooler because they seem to be temperature dependent, and especially the non-natives.
So when you cook stinging nettle, How do you cook it?
Oh, so for singing needle, I pick the tips and the leaves, and I just blanch, and it completely, all the stinging completely goes away. I didn't believe it at first, but it's true.
All right. Looks like our next caller will probably go to Patrick Alley in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania. Hello.
Yes. Good day. My question is, how safe are vegetables that come from urban gardens? I know that the cars come by and, you know, there's fumes and all kinds of byproducts. And then there's cats that come through the yards where they have these urban gardens. And people, they give me vegetables, and I wonder how safe they are to eat.
Good question. Thanks for the call, Allie.
So there's two ways to think about this. One is what are the conditions of the soil or the histories of the soils in which plants in an urban area are grown. Most urban farms take extreme caution to grow the plants in imported soil that's on top of sort of the historical layer of a vacant lot or a different lot. There's a plastic layer and then a couple feet of mulch and then soil brought in, composting. That's sort of one pathway for thinking about the exposure. The other one is any deposition that's coming from the air or rain that might be sort of dropping things onto plants. And there really the question is, are you washing things well, as I understand it? So you want to make sure and be careful to wash these greens very well. But this is true of the way that we should handle many vegetables coming from various areas to ensure that we're getting herbicides or pesticide residues or these type of contaminants that might be deposited on sort of the leaf surface.
Let's get to another issue. Patrick, it seems that for many conservationists, the jury is still out on urban foraging. A certain amount is tolerated, but they want to protect the resource. Is that an accurate observation?
I think it's very much an accurate observation. The other thing I would say is there's a tension here between developing an awareness and concern for the management of forests and various native habitats. Mm-hmm. And this is sometimes seen as one pathway into developing that awareness and concern versus introducing a practice to folks who might then not engage in harvesting practices that benefit the local ecologies. What we've learned in studies from Seattle, where there's quite a bit of urban foraging and there's been some change in park policy there, the research shows that many urban foragers engage in a lot of different stewardship or sustainability practices. They limit the amount of a plant they harvest, or they limit the amount of individuals of a population of plants in a given area. They avoid areas that where they can tell that someone else has harvested. They may engage in weeding activities that are removing invasive species that are competing with native species, and that's helping the population of plants that the managers are also concerned about thrive. So they're engaged in some ways, they're engaged in some of the very activities that that managers are recruiting volunteers to engage in, mm-hmm. in stewardship and restoration activities. That said, one of the things I'd point out is what we're talking about is not just the harvest of wild plants. We're talking about the harvest of ornamental plants, but we're also sometimes talking about the harvest of actively restored plants in an ecological restoration project.
Sure.
And so managers are very concerned in those situations. What I would say is here, some managers in some areas are saying, wait, let's think about this and what are the opportunities that we might have to engage the broader public in learning about native species, learning about native ecosystems, what have you, and use it as a recruitment tool.
Tama, sustainability, we've got issues, or you've come across issues, like for instance with the ramp.
Yeah, so well, so in my book I have a sustainability code for every single species, and for Patrick and conservationists, it's pretty 101. But again, it's part of the education. So non-native plants and invasive plants, harvest all you want, 100%. Don't use a 30%. There's some kind of 30% measure. Native plants, there's two ways they grow. Generalist, which is kind of like a sumac. They're pretty weedy type. And the others are specialist native plants. And I think those are the ones that managers are very concerned about. For example, ramps is really one of those. Mm-hmm. You may see a lot of them now, but they're very specialized. And if you pull out there are studies showing now that if you pull out the entire plant, especially, which is what people are doing, they're not just clipping the tops.
What you should do?
Well, if you're going to.
Because when you eat a ramp, how do you cook with it?
Well, you just put with it. No, people are pickling the bulbs.
So it's also known as a wild leek, and so it's a very similar type plant.
Yeah, so you can do the tops, but you don't have to, right? We're not using this to, but the main point is it's not growing back. And in fact, as you're disturbing the soil and digging out these things, you are actually opening it to invasive plants to come in. And that's just these plant managers who are spending so much time trying to maintain the diversity of the remaining ecosystems we have. It's really overturning that. And for example, I've been doing stuff with the Natural Lands Trust, and they said that they found some woman digging, you know, actually digging with a shovel ramps out of their property, just coming in. You know, so I think that's what they're worried about. But if they followed the sustainability code, I think that that would encourage managers to find, maybe if they were supervised in doing it, especially a way, you know, forward to help both be a win-win, maybe.
Another species of concern that occurs in our area is ginseng, right? There's a long history of ginseng harvest in the eastern United States. But the thing I would add here is it's not just parks, it's also sort of private forest lands. And that might be wild ginseng, or it might be an example of what Tom is doing, is forest farming. And so those landowners are actively managing or planting those individual ginseng plants to harvest for their economic use. And so there's some, you know, things to think about. Again, ask permission on private property whether
this would also be enough. Just thinking out loud, Patrick got me thinking that way. For people who are in an urban environment and all you've got is a container, so plant some native species, plant some bee balm, plant some anise hyssop, or plant something that is edible, but that is actually a great habitat plant too. And then, you know, that can get over some of your issues about, is this okay? Does someone spray it? Do I have permission?
And before you get back to the phones, they can be really good for pollinators as well, the native plants.
Yes.
Okay. Galen in Bertrandville, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome. All right. Let's go to – okay. We are going to continue with our conversation. We don't have our callers with us right now. I had pulled, Tama, from your book because you've got some recipes there. And I love ravioli. so I saw your recipe for wild herb ravioli. And in it – this is real interesting – 1.5 cups of firmly packed dead nettle – or henbit tops, including the flowers. And there's that nettle again. 2 cups of firmly packed chickweed and 3/4 of a cup of wild garlic greens or chives. And, of course, that's in addition to the cheeses and et cetera. Sounds like a pungent dish.
Okay.
Describe it.
So
describe
first,
the flavor.
Okay, the thing, I love this. This is one of my favorite recipes. And most people are familiar with ravioli. So the thing I love about this is because people have eaten spinach ravioli. And when you eat this, you'll see how the flavor is so much more alive. It's more fresh. It's got that kind of dark green flavor. And you realize that it's superior to spinach. So I love to have this. And actually, I am working on doing an event in November 1 with Canal House Cooking, which is in Lambertsville, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And it's at the Brick Farm Market in Hopewell. And they're going to be serving some kind of wild herb ravioli at that.
Have you had a chance to really look at the nutritional content?
Well, that's what
really
this book
okay.
that I mentioned before, Eating on the Wild Side, she has researched all the studies that have been done. Mm-hmm. And that book is – I was so excited to read it.
How would you describe the trend toward wild foods being included in restaurants? I know you work for a number of restaurants as a forager.
Yes, a number.
Okay.
Yes. And I have a distributor that distributes to Philadelphia also,
so
Zone 7.
How do you work with the primary chef that you work with? Is it a Daniel?
No, I work with a number now.
Okay.
You know, because people hear and they, but why are they so interested? Because they're looking for flavor. And they feel like a lot of the ingredients they get, and if you've been working 6 or 7 days a week and looking at the same strawberries over and over, and they're getting sometimes blander and blander and watery. And so they're looking for things that have real flavor and that they can, gives them the edge, really.
And I would say this is actually an international trend. You see restaurants in Denmark and Copenhagen. You see restaurants in Istanbul, Turkey, that advertise the serving of wild forage foods. And it's part of, to some extent, part of a tradition. There are a couple of restaurants in Seattle that only serve wild forage foods.
So one of the restaurants is the co-founder of NoMa, the Copenhagen place, and he now has a place in New York City called Acme. So he's just his name is Mads, and he is mad for forage stuff. So everything. Yes.
So when it comes to putting a menu together, though, it's got to be a bit of a challenge because it's not like you're farming.
That's where I need my lawyer skills, right? How to execute, how to get volume and consistency, how to deliver quality.
The crop isn't necessarily going to be done June 15th. So how do you work to produce a menu in that situation?
We have to kind of set things. Like if something's going to go on the menu, then, you know, there's pressure. So, and I have different places which are on a south to north contingency, right? So that it extends the season. And I have ways that I pick things so that it extends the season. I mean, it works for our household also because we get to enjoy it more. But yes, when you get to a commercial level, there are other things you have to make sure in order to provide, you know, the kind of value that their customers are expecting.
And this is actually one area where we see that cities make a difference. The city and the urban heat island effect can actually extend the seasonality of some plants and actually make some plants accessible. You know, you hear about figs, which were sort of, you know, not that uncommon, but sometimes you hear about olive trees in the area and some other plants that would not really be found in the Philadelphia, sort of outside of the city, that this urban heat island offers a new foraging or new harvesting opportunity. I was going to quickly mention a great nut that you can find now, which is great substitute for making ice cream, is hickory nuts.
Mm.
And so you can use a toasted almond or toasted.
Even better, you can make an ice cream out of the bark, shag bark, hickory bark ice cream. Oh, I have my recipe online.
All right. Well, we'll have to look for that. Stop you there on a tasty ending to this to this hour. Tama Matsuaka Wong, author of the book Forage Flavor, Finding Fabulous Ingredients in Your Backyard or Farmer's Market. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Patrick Hurley studies urban foraging and is Associate Professor of Environmental Studies and Chair at Ursinus College. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Just a reminder, you can head to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about our Facebook page and podcasts. Our engineer today has been Adam Staniszewski. Our producers, Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.